Hello, and welcome to Conversations from the World of Allergy, a podcast produced by the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. I'm your host, Dave Stukas. I'm a board-certified allergist and immunologist and serve as a social media medical editor for the Academy. Our podcast series will use different formats to interview thought leaders from the world of allergy and immunology. This podcast is not intended to provide any individual medical advice to our listeners. We do hope that our conversations provide evidence-based information. Any questions pertaining to one's own health should always be discussed with their personal physician. The Find an Allergist search engine on the Academy website is a useful tool to locate a listing of board-certified allergists in your area. Finally, use of this audio program is subject to the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Terms of Use Agreement, which you can find at www.aaaai.org. Today's edition of our Conversations from the World of Allergy podcast series is timely, given the fact that it is Food Allergy Awareness Week, which is when we're going to launch this. And it's going to be targeted towards both medical professionals and the general public, and especially anybody who's living with or has a child who has food allergies. And I think this is going to be a fantastic conversation. We have one of the world's leading food allergy experts with us. Today's guest is Dr. Catherine Anagnostou. Dr. Anagnostou is a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Immunology, Allergy, and Retrovirology at Texas Children's Hospital and Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. She serves as the director of the Food Immunotherapy Program and is co-director of the Food Allergy Program at her institution. And Dr. Anagnostou also currently serves as the chair of the Adverse Reactions to Foods Committee within the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. With that, Dr. Anagnostou, thank you so much for taking the time to join us and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Dave, and thank you for having me.
No, I think this is going to be a wonderful conversation. It's very timely, as I mentioned. But let's begin. I want to learn a little bit more about you, if that's okay. We like to learn more about our guests. And you've really devoted your career towards food allergy research, advocacy, education, and caring for children with food allergies. Where did your interest in food allergy begin, and what keeps your passion going so strong for all these years?
So you take me back quite a few years with this question now, Dave. I was training in pediatrics in London, and I was considering a different career specialty path altogether. When one night I was doing a shift in the emergency department, and a young teenage boy came in with some friends of his, and he was having anaphylaxis. So I got to talk to him, and he was peanut allergic. He was a bit puzzled as to how he ended up in the emergency department, because he said he was very good at checking labels, and he had checked the food before eating, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, when you work in the ED and sometimes you get the feeling that you're missing something, you're not getting the full story. So that's the feeling I got from his friends, who looked increasingly uncomfortable as we were discussing anaphylaxis and obviously the risks of exposures. So I got them to a side room to speak to them privately, and it ended up that they thought it would be funny to hide some peanut powder in his food. Mm. And they had no idea how dangerous that was and what it would cause. So that kind of struck me, and I was quite affected by this particular case. I realized the lack of awareness that exists. I mean, these kids had no bad intentions. It's not a case of bullying or anything like this. It was just lack of awareness and lack of knowledge. So I decided to find a little bit more out about food allergies, because my training in food allergies as a medical student had also been pretty limited. And I signed up for a food allergy course in one of the hospitals in London. Loved the people, loved the course, and never really looked back. I found the field very interesting. I thought it had incredible untapped potential for research, education, advocacy, and all the areas that you just described. And I guess going to the second part of your question about what keeps me going, obviously my patients do, because we all choose medicine to help people, and I think that stays with us for the duration of our careers. My research too, I have a lot of questions that I would like to answer during, let's say, my service in this space. And of course, my colleagues are also pretty fantastic. I collaborate, I'm very fortunate actually to collaborate with an amazing group of people who challenge me and inspire me to do better every single day.
Well, it sounds like you love your job, which is always encouraging to hear. And the passion just really comes through in your description. What an interesting sort of origin story with that patient that came into the emergency room one night. Wow. You and I have kind of similar jobs because we both run our distinct food allergy programs at our institutions, but by no means are we alone. There's, you know, multiple of these types of programs across the country and across the world, and they're being more and more developed. How does the care offered within these types of food allergy centers differ from a general allergy practice?
Yeah, that's a great question. We do need to see more and more of these sort of coming in different places, including, I think, in areas that previously did not have much awareness about food allergies. And I think food allergy being quite a complex disease in a lot of ways. The way we interpret food allergy tests is not intuitive, but non-specialists cannot really do it. So these centers, I think, are very much needed because people are seeking specialist skills and knowledge to deal with their food allergy. The way that they differ, I mean, they differ, I guess, in quite a few ways. The infrastructure can be quite different. In my academic center here where I work, I'm quite fortunate to have really good infrastructure. We have dedicated space for our food challenges. We have a nice sort of dedicated buzzing clinical area with separate rooms for each individual patient, so they have their privacy. We are also fortunate to have a multidisciplinary team that works with us, including multiple dietitians and also clinical psychologists, and they are absolutely incredible, and they're an integral part of our team and what we do every day for patients. So I guess all of that is not necessarily present in every single general allergy practice or food allergy practice. But I have to point out that I think that what makes a practice different is the dedication and the passion of the people that run it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, we're not saying one is better than the other by any stretch, but it is just a different infrastructure, as you mentioned. You know, one thing I've noticed myself is when I'm just seeing food allergy all day, every day, I've noticed like the subtle patterns and the nuances and the differences from one child to the next, even though they have the same food allergy, it may be very different in regards to severity. And we're going to talk about some of this, I'm sure. Just, you know, out of curiosity, have you noticed that as well, of just being able to kind of focus on one condition? Does that bring out different types of pattern recognition perhaps?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a really important thing to note that when we get taught and when we teach others, we teach them about the disease, not about individual patients. So I can teach my trainees about peanut allergy. I cannot teach them about all the peanut allergic patients they're going to see, because every single one of them is going to be different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's switch gears a little bit to, you know, Food Allergy Awareness Week, which occurs every year in May. It's also Asthma Awareness Month, which we had a recent podcast on as well. What does food allergy awareness mean to you?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? It's a very interesting word, this word awareness. It means to obviously know about something, be able to potentially talk about it and discuss it. I think for me, it has a little bit of a deeper meaning, because I think in order to be aware, you have to be able to put yourself into that person's shoes and actually see what life looks like from their perspective. That's how I view awareness. We run a wonderful fundraising event here every year where we get chefs, restaurant chefs from the city of Houston to come and cook for us. And obviously the people who attend the event, including food allergic families, but anybody else who is interested in food allergies. And what we did one year was we assigned everybody a food allergy. So we gave them the tickets and we said, this is your ticket and this is the food allergy you have for the night. And now for tonight, you have to avoid all the food items that you cannot eat because of your food allergy. And I can tell you that actually gave people a really good insight into at least part of the burden that our food allergic children and their families have to go through every day with checking labels, communicating the food allergy, making sure that they don't accidentally get exposed to food trigger. And it made a lot of non-allergic people realize that avoidance is not an easy thing to do.
Oh, what a wonderful event. I would love to join you one day for that. Sounds delicious as well.
You are very welcome to.
And I like how you said awareness is almost like compassion and empathy, right? Of just helping everybody understand what it's like, because these people don't have a choice in having food allergies, correct?
Yes, I think you're right. I think compassion also comes into it, and it's one of the things that unfortunately we cannot teach.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the areas where I see a ton of confusion, I'm sure you do as well, and I think this will help set the stage for today's conversation. Can you start just by defining what a food allergy is and then also just tell us how that differs from a food intolerance?
Right. How many times do we answer that in our clinics, right? At least multiple times a week, if not every day, right?
Yeah.
So food allergy is basically an abnormal response of the immune system that sees food as an enemy and attacks harmless, usually proteins that are in that food. Intolerance is quite different. The immune system is not involved. It's usually a sort of enzyme deficiency, and I guess one of the most common intolerances that we come across is lactose intolerance, where people are missing the enzyme lactase that breaks down the sugars in the milk. Intolerances are not associated with anaphylaxis. That's important to note. And they have a completely different, obviously, mechanism. They're not food allergies. These two things are very different, and these terms should not be used interchangeably.
Mm-hmm. You know, another area of common confusion that I see, I know you do as well, are the fact that, you know, food allergy tests are widely available, you know, skin prick tests that we offer in our office setting, and blood testing that really anybody can order, any medical professional, or now we have direct-to-consumer food allergy testing as well. What's the best way to use these tests when evaluating somebody with suspected food allergy?
Yeah, so we go back to the very, very first principle that we all learn in medical school, that we instantly forget when we start practicing, and then after a few years, it comes back to us with a vengeance, which is basically a 90% of the diagnosis for a patient is in the medical history. And I think this is even more so for diseases like food allergies. So all of these tests are pretty much useless if you don't have the information of the food allergic reaction. So you have to interpret them within the context of the patient having had a reaction to the food. Otherwise, all that they show is that the patient is sensitized, so has some antibodies to the food kind of floating around, but not necessarily any clinical reactivity or clinical allergy.
So the test alone does not diagnose food allergy. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
It does not. You are correct.
Okay. Do the skin or blood tests tell us anything about the severity of someone's allergy?
No, it would be nice if they did, in a way. It would help us risk stratify patients better, I think, but unfortunately, they do not. So somebody who has, say, a peanut specific ID of 50 and somebody who has a peanut specific ID of 20, we don't really know which one of them has more severe peanut allergy. They don't really give us any indication with regards to that.
You know, one of the things I've seen over the years, I'm curious if you have as well, if I'll have a new adolescent patient who was, say, diagnosed with a peanut allergy or food allergy by another allergist when they were, you know, a child, a young child, and they were told something along the lines of, oh my gosh, I've never seen a skin test that size to your food allergy, or this says that you're deathly allergic, or things like that. And then it just stays with them every single day for the rest of their lives because they were told that incorrect information. Is that something that you've encountered as well?
I know. What a terrible thing to say to somebody, right? I mean, people come in with all sorts of things, and I've never heard the dermatologist say, oh my gosh, you have the most awful rash I have ever seen. Right? you know, I don't know why people feel comfortable saying this to food allergic patients. Yes, I have. And it's as you say, it's stays with them forever, and it also takes a lot of work to get them to actually understand that this is not true. So yes.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. Along those lines, can you give us some, you know, some of the common incorrect applications of food allergy testing that you see in your practice? How are these being misused, I guess is the question I want to ask.
Yeah, I guess I'm not going to surprise anyone here. One sort of incorrect application that I see very commonly is panel testing. So people sort of either have a reaction to one food and then they get panel testing to a whole other range of completely unrelated foods, a lot of which they're already eating without any problems. Positives come up, like false positives, and then there is this whole mess of being told to avoid foods that they were previously eating without any issues. Because someone has told them that this is now a food allergy, going back to incorrect testing interpretation that we've discussed just now. And the second, I guess, is young kids and infants with eczema. I don't know when we're going to stop seeing these. They present somewhere and the parents are convinced that the eczema is due to the food, because of course eczema flares up multiple times and infants eat multiple times. So while the chances the two will coincide, quite high, right? And they get told that the kids need allergy testing, and again they get like a whole load of testing done with lots of false positives often coming up, so to avoid the food, et cetera, et cetera. So I think those two are probably the ones that I see most frequently, just general panel testing and infants with eczema getting tested to a variety of foods without paying any attention to the actual history.
Yeah, you know, along those lines, so just to kind of recap, because you've done a great job of describing this very, very concisely and very eloquently, you've mentioned that the proper diagnosis of food allergy really comes down to taking a detailed medical history. As you said, something we all learned in medical school, but we often forget along the way. And then if that history is suggestive for food allergy, then we want to carefully consider what types of testing we want to order and then interpret them in the proper context. But this is quite opposite from now what is widely available, all these at-home IgE food allergy tests. So what can you tell us when we have, you know, questions about this from our patients or colleagues or loved ones, frankly? You know, what are your thoughts on that approach?
Oh my gosh, right. And you talked about IgE food testing. What about the IgG food testing, right? Hold it.
We don't have enough time for that.
We don't have enough time. I agree. It's absolutely crazy what is out there. And I think we have a lot of work to do with tackling all the misinformation and all the misconceptions. And this is a lot your area, actually, Dave. I should give you a shout out for all the job you've done and all the work you've done in this space. It's difficult. I think we need to spend time with our families. We need to talk to people, to our patients in particular. We need to explain why this shouldn't be done. We need to try to explain how these tests work in simple terms that are understandable by everybody, regardless of whether they have any medical background or not. And we need to provide them the right sort of evidence-based information in order to get them to understand why these tests are not only useless most of the time, but they are also harmful.
Tell us more about that. Why is it harmful if we're misdiagnosing food allergy?
Well, think about it like this. If you say to somebody that they have an allergy to, say, milk, what's the first thing they're going to do? The first thing they're going to do is take milk out of the diet. Now, in addition to all the nutritional issues that this can cause, we now know that, for example, in young infants, if you introduce foods early, you most likely prevent the development of food allergy. Now, imagine that same infant being told, well, the parents being told that same infant has milk allergy, milk comes out of the diet. Now, that infant may be now at higher risk of developing food allergy because you've just taken away one of the foods that should go into the diet reasonably early. So that's one sort of thing I can think of that is pretty sort of harmful. But in addition to this, carrying a label of any kind of food allergy is a pretty huge burden. So it comes with a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety about exposure, severe reactions, anaphylaxis, etc. It comes with a lot of social type limitations, school activities and parties and going out to restaurants and traveling. And then you also have the financial burden. In addition to hospital visits, allergen-free foods are not cheap. They're pretty expensive. So it can be harmful in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, speaking of sort of the fear and anxiety that goes with this diagnosis, and it's just so common, it's 2024 now, and I still see these scary and just grossly inaccurate food allergy headlines and stories that get spread wide and far on social media. Can you help us better understand what an accurate representation of risk is in regard to food allergies? I mean, some of these stories make it seem like everybody's a ticking time bomb just waiting to have a life-threatening reaction. Is that true? Can you help us understand this a little bit more?
Yeah, there is definitely a lot of fear surrounding this, and I see it a lot in my clinics too. I want to say from my personal experience, half of the people who come into my clinic have this idea in their head that either that the child, I'm a pediatrician, so I see the kids, but the child is likely to have a life-threatening reaction the next day. And of course, that's not true. It's very difficult to capture rates of anaphylaxis accurately. And a lot of the studies that have been done are based on self-reports. So we know that self-reports generally overestimate rates of food allergy, of anaphylaxis, I'm sorry. And then the other thing is that we also capture anaphylaxis based on visits to the ED. But again, patients may not go to the ED with anaphylaxis always. So that's a way of sort of underestimating the rate. But I think generally anaphylaxis is less common than what the prevalence kind of self-report studies tell us. And I also think that based on the evidence we have, fatal outcomes, which again, drag a huge fear into everyone, are exceedingly rare. I hope that's reassuring for the food allergic individuals out there. And this is not to minimize the importance of anaphylaxis and the prompt treatment that needs to happen when anaphylaxis occurs. It's just putting it into the right context.
Yeah, absolutely. For our listeners who aren't aware, Catherine and some of her colleagues have really led the charge, especially in recent years, in helping us better understand life-threatening and fatal anaphylaxis and sort of the evidence behind it. So I encourage you to look at, you know, some of her review articles and original research and things like that. And we're very fortunate to have you with us today. And while we have you here, and this is a good time, can we pause for a second and maybe do some anaphylaxis myth busting? Would that be okay?
Yeah, sure. That sounds great. Let's do it.
All right. So this is always a point of confusion. Can you just describe what anaphylaxis is?
Yeah. So various societies have tried to define anaphylaxis. And I think although the definitions may be a little bit slightly different, let's say, from society to society, generally when we talk about anaphylaxis, we're referring to a systemic reaction that usually affects multiple organ systems and can potentially be life-threatening. And it's usually rapid in onset, it tests pretty quickly, and it's also rapidly evolving. So symptoms can progress pretty fast. I think this is probably the best definition I've seen, and it comes out mostly of the most updated food allergy parameter document that was published in 2023, which is actually a fantastic document. I have to give a shout out to all the authors, and I would encourage everyone listening to look into it.
All right. So rapid in onset, involving more than one part of the body, and it's going to occur with typically ingestion of the allergen, or is this going to be common when somebody's just, you know, near it, or if they're breathing in the dust from, say, somebody opening a bag of peanuts?
Generally, you have to ingest the allergen in order to have anaphylaxis. I have heard, again, a lot of concerns about this. A lot of my patients would say that they have to sit at separate tables at school because of fear that touching someone's peanut butter sandwich can cause anaphylaxis. I mean, touching the food allergen could potentially give people hives in the area where it was, where it made contact, but it's highly unlikely that it would cause a severe reaction such as anaphylaxis.
All right. What's the number one and only effective treatment for anaphylaxis?
Epinephrine. Intramuscular epinephrine. That's a key message. I'm glad you brought it up like that, because everybody needs to know that this is the treatment for anaphylaxis.
Okay. So should somebody wait to use epinephrine until their throat is swelling shut or they have difficulty breathing?
So the general recommendation is to use it at the first sign and symptoms of anaphylaxis, and not to wait until your symptoms are really, really bad. I think I'm going to take this a little bit further, and I kind of try to uncouple the words epinephrine and anaphylaxis in the sense that sometimes people look at their action plan. So I'm like, well, I wasn't sure if the reaction I was seeing in my child in front of me was fulfilling like all the criteria for me to treat with epinephrine. It seems pretty severe, but I wasn't sure it ticked all the boxes. So I'm going to say if your child is having a severe allergic reaction, or if you yourself are having a severe allergic reaction, go ahead and give epinephrine. It's probably not very helpful at this type of situation to start thinking, well, did I fulfill criteria 3 and criteria 4? Mm-hmm. And am I good to give it? So I would say first signs and symptoms of anaphylaxis, go ahead and give epi. If you're having a severe reaction and you're concerned, give epi again.
I love it. You know, I've been on a soapbox for years talking about albuterol when people refer to it as an emergency inhaler, because that infers to people that you shouldn't use it until it's an emergency. And I think the same rules apply with epinephrine, right? It's a medicine that's going to make you feel better pretty fast. And the sooner you use it, the better it works. Would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. I agree completely. And I think our bodies know that too, because they also produce it in severe reactions, which is quite good to know.
Yeah. As a quick aside, I had a recent experience during a food challenge where it was sort of, you know, mild anaphylaxis. I knew epinephrine was going to make them feel better during a food challenge. But at the same time, the poor child was just so upset and they were screaming and crying. And I started to kind of in my, you know, not smile outwardly, but I was like, oh, well, they're really ramping up their own epinephrine here. So that's a pretty, pretty good treatment that they got going already.
Yes, I think that's also the explanation for why some instances who do not receive actually epinephrine, unfortunately, also recover, because patient is probably producing quite enough of this. But this is not, we shouldn't be relying on this. We should absolutely be administering epinephrine.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, here's another sort of myth that we can bust, hopefully. Do food allergy reactions get worse with each subsequent ingestion?
So there's no good evidence to actually support that statement. And again, it is something that I hear quite a lot in my clinics. People come in, the child has had a mild reaction, and they're like, oh, we've been told that every single one after this is getting worse and worse and worse. I think it's a misconception, or at least we don't have good evidence right now to support it. And there are a lot of different factors that play a role in how severe reaction you're going to have. Obviously, it depends on how much you're going to eat and what your threshold is to the food that you're exposed to. It also depends on whether you're well or unwell on the day, because, again, illnesses can affect your threshold of reaction. So there are so many different things. I've just mentioned a couple, but there's a ton of different things that can influence the severity of an allergic reaction. And this, we can't really predict in that sense what the next reaction will look like.
Yeah. And, you know, if this sounds familiar to you, I'm pretty much pulling these from your publications, because your work on, you know, these cofactors and whatnot, it really enlightened me and helped me and so many others just really understand this. So it's such a pleasure to have you here. And I'm going to keep going if that's okay. We're going to take full advantage of this opportunity.
It's absolutely fine. It's not just my work, actually. I worked with a colleague in London who's fantastic, Cole Turner. He has done a tremendous volume of work in this space.
Yes, yes, couldn't agree more. All right, will antihistamines mask anaphylaxis?
It's unlikely. True anaphylaxis progresses pretty rapidly, and the only medication we have that reverses the symptoms of anaphylaxis, as we've mentioned multiple times by now, is epinephrine. Antihistamines can help with itching, they can help with hives. But if anaphylaxis is going to progress to more severe sort of symptoms, if the allergic reaction actually is going to progress to more severe symptoms, the antihistamines are not going to stop that. So no. And again, don't rely on antihistamines in case of severe symptoms. Go ahead and give epinephrine.
All right. You know, we've seen some widespread campaigns from some advocacy organizations and others that, you know, have declared that even trace amounts can kill you, which is really scary if you think about that, because that means that very minimal ingestion could potentially cause a life-threatening reaction. Is this really true, or is that really out of context?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a great question. And it also brings up another question, like, what do you mean by trace amounts, right? So patients have different thresholds at which they react. And like was said at the beginning of this podcast, every patient is very different. So we see a very wide variation in terms of the level of the food protein that individual patients react. We're trying to quantify this in phyllo waste, and threshold is also known as a lifting dose. So we're looking at lifting doses for individuals with food allergy across various populations. And there's something called the ADO1, which is basically a lifting dose at which 1% of the food allergic population will have a reaction. So lifting dose 1 and lifting dose 5, or lifting dose 5, 5% of individuals with food allergy are likely to have a reaction. Those are sort of the lowest amounts that we expect some people to react. So Paul and I actually looked at this together with some other colleagues for peanut allergic individuals. We wanted to see how many will actually have anaphylaxis to those really low amounts. And we found a very, very small number. So there was something like 1 in 2,500 patients that were peanut allergic that would have anaphylaxis to the ADO1, and something like 6 per 2,500 patients, if I remember correctly, for the ADO5. So actually, anaphylaxis to trace amount is pretty rare, and fatalities even more so. Again, looking at serious health fatalities, it's quite difficult to quantify the amount that caused it. There's always missing information in these cases, or information that doesn't come out. But there was a small scenario review that looked at this, and they found that for those exposures, those fatal exposures where the amount was known, none of these were associated with trace amounts. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, based on the information we have right now, and based on the studies and the research that we have performed, trace amounts of any food are highly unlikely to kill you.
Okay. There was a widely circulated food allergy treatment plan for a while that had a little box at the top, and it said, if checked, give epinephrine immediately if the food allergen was eaten, even if no symptoms occur, or something like that. So, if somebody with a food allergy thinks that they might have eaten their allergen, but they're asymptomatic at that time, should they use their epinephrine immediately?
Yeah, this is happily addressed in the practice parameter as well. So I didn't even have to think too much about it, because other people have. But generally, we don't recommend that this is done if there are no symptoms whatsoever, because there's no evidence that preemptive use of epinephrine is going to prevent anaphylaxis from developing. And also, the drug works for a short amount of time, and then it comes out of your system. So using it without any symptoms whatsoever probably wouldn't help in that sense either. Now, if somebody, let's say, has had an awful, truly life-threatening reaction in the past, they needed multiple doses of epinephrine, they ended up in ICU, which again is extremely rare. These are extremely rare cases. Understandably, there will be a tremendous amount of anxiety at any kind of ingestion of the allergen. So at that point, this can be more of a shared decision-making conversation in terms of using epinephrine if they think they have ingested the allergen that that made them end up in ICU. But generally speaking, using epinephrine preemptively is, we don't think it's beneficial.
Okay. You've touched upon this a couple of times already, and it's always such a difficult conversation to have because it's nuanced, and it there's a lot of emotions surrounding it. And it's tragic when it does occur. But you've had several publications that have looked at food allergy anaphylaxis and really fatal anaphylaxis. Can you give us some perspective about how often, somebody has a fatal food allergy reaction?
Yeah, again, I want to stress these are exceedingly rare. And as you say, they're also extremely sad when they do happen. They get a lot of publicity, and a lot of people are worried about this, understandably. But when we look at fatality rates for food-induced anaphylaxis in particular, and compare them with fatality rates from other things, like, say, a traffic accident, or dying because someone murders you, or death from lightning, actually, food-induced anaphylaxis is close to death by lightning. So This is sort of close to the risk that you would have dying from food-induced anaphylaxis. As a range, I generally give a range of anywhere between 1 in a million to 1 in 10 million for fatalities. Again, exceedingly rare, awful, absolutely awful events to happen. Definitely not intending to minimize the importance here. But again, it's important that people have a realistic idea and the right context for these rather than just living every day in fear.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And you've already mentioned this about how parents are worried that their child's going to have a life-threatening reaction the next day or in the near future. And you and I meet people every day who really list this as their number one concern. They're afraid they or their child are going to die from their food allergy. Years ago, I started asking the question when they come to me with these concerns of how many children a year do you think, you know, die from peanut allergy? And it's amazing. I've had parents tell me they think that, you know, 5,000 children are dying a year from this, which no wonder they're scared out of their minds, right? It's just, yeah. And then, you know, as you mentioned, without the proper context, now they're really restricting their activities, their travel, their just ability to enjoy life because this is their perception. So what do you do at your center? How can we, all of us, help these individuals better understand the reality compared with this perception that they have?
I think we have to present them with the evidence, put everything in the right context, and explain clearly how rare this outcome is. And then we have to, I think, empower them with knowledge and give them some tools to increase their confidence in how to protect themselves. So obviously, if you have good avoidance strategies and techniques and you're able to avoid your food allergy trigger, you will never have to worry about this. If you're able to identify signs and symptoms of an allergic reaction and know how to treat it, and you know to use epinephrine promptly in case of severe reactions and anaphylaxis, again, already you have layers of protection against something like this happening. Because one of the risk factors that were actually shown in various studies is that if you delay the use of epinephrine, you can have poor outcomes. And the same goes with uncontrolled asthma. So we need to educate our patients to treat anaphylaxis appropriately, to use epinephrine promptly if they are concerned and if they have significant symptoms, and also those asthmatic patients to make sure that their asthma is under control. So I sometimes speak to very anxious families and I say, we all drive, right? But we know that car accidents are actually pretty frequent, nowhere near the rate of anaphylaxis or fatalities, right? They are very, very frequent. So none of us say, I'm never going to get in my car again because I worry that an accident will happen. We just take precautions, right? So we drive as safely as possible. We learn the rules of the road. We use seatbelts. So in the same way, I think we can take some of that fear and anxiety away by empowering patients. And if they feel like they have the knowledge of what to do in case of a severe reaction, hopefully that fear is minimized together with the evidence and the right context for the rate of fatalities.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something before, which is now sort of, I think, becoming established as like a current approach towards, you know, individualized management. And this is the concept of these threshold challenges of, you know, having somebody ingest really small amounts of their allergen. Can you tell us a little bit more about what those entail and, you know, how that can guide management decisions for each individual?
Yes. So using threshold challenges can help in quite a few different ways. It can help in terms of knowing the level that somebody reacts to by, for example, guiding some of those patients who have very high thresholds to incorporate foods with precautionary labeling, right? So if someone, let's say, doesn't react to peanut up to a level of 100 milligrams or 300 milligrams, it's unlikely that they're going to have a reaction to a trace amount or a cross-contact or cross-contamination amount. And this can help with removing some of the dietary limitations. On the other hand, now that we have treatments coming through for food allergies, especially oral immunotherapy, knowing the threshold at which a patient reacts can help us with individualizing therapy. So if we know that they react, for example, to 50 milligrams, we don't really need to start oral immunotherapy from 1 milligram. We can just start a little bit lower below the threshold, and that's going to save them time, it's going to save effort, it's going to save number of visits. And for some patients, if their thresholds are very, very high, say somebody already has a threshold of 300 milligrams, depending on what they're wanting to achieve as a therapy, all they're looking for is protection from accidental exposures, they may actually not need it. So it can help us both with removing potentially some of the dietary restrictions, but also with therapies and choice of therapies and level at starting therapies.
No, I think that's a great description of that. And, you know, personally, I use the word empowering. I couldn't agree more. That's what these visits are. We're helping them understand what their child's food allergy is like, or their own food allergy, and to watch them actually eat some of their allergen, which they previously thought would, you know, could cause a life-threatening reaction at even small doses. It just gives them that knowledge and that experience and that confidence moving forward. I couldn't agree more.
Yes, you're right. That's true, actually. That's another benefit that they can get, especially very anxious families. And they can get that benefit, I guess, from not just threshold challenges, but any type of oral food challenge. Some kids have never actually experienced an allergic reaction, mm-hmm. or have not experienced an allergic reaction for many, many years. They don't remember it. They have experienced it at some point, but they don't remember it. So it can empower them in a lot of different ways. And thresholds are relatively reproducible, so they're quite a good sort of basis to work from. But it's important to note that sometimes they can be influenced by various cofactors. So there have been mm-hmm. studies looking at how exercise, sleep deprivation, illness can affect your threshold. So that's information that I always provide to my patients as well, just to make sure that they have the full picture here.
Right. Great point. Yeah, the conversation of, okay, this is where you reacted at a baseline, but if you eat the same amount while you're playing soccer, things can be very different. Yeah.
Correct.
So speaking of oral food challenges, these are, you know, widely considered the gold standard for assessing true allergic potential and diagnosing food allergy when the story's sort of indeterminate, testing's wishy-washy, don't quite know what's going on. Why are they the gold standard? And then also, why are they not more readily available?
I think we have earned their place, actually, as a gold standard in the food allergy space, because they do provide us with a definitive answer on whether someone is food allergic or not, if there's any doubt or if the history is unclear. Sometimes they can be inconclusive, usually if the child is reluctant to eat the food, but for the majority of occasions, they give us an answer one way or another. They're also, I think, the only reliable measure we have of assessing the threshold or the listing dose for individuals. So that's also very beneficial. So why are they not more readily available? I mean, they are quite laborious. So you need to have space for food challenges. They take a long amount of time to be done in the allergy clinic. You need staff that is dedicated to this, to give the doses to the children, to also monitor them in case they have an allergic reaction. They're quite costly as well on a lot of occasions. So I think for all of these reasons, they are not as widely available as we would like. But I consider them one of the best tools that we have in our arsenal as allergists.
Yeah, it's the best part of my job. I agree. And have you ever had somebody thank you after, even if they had anaphylaxis and received epinephrine during a food challenge?
So, yes, I mean, people are often grateful when they finally get an answer. And I know that the word anaphylaxis has all these negative connotations, and in a way it has earned these connotations, but there are also some benefits in a way to having an anaphylactic reaction. I often encourage my teenage patients to self-administer epinephrine in the clinic mm-hmm. if they have an anaphylactic reaction when they're there. And again, they found it very empowering. I remember one patient that was absolutely terrified of ever needing epinephrine, came for a challenge in the clinic, and guess what? Needed epinephrine. So I convinced them to self-administer. They did it, and then they looked at me and they said, "Oh, that's it." So it was one of the best times, right? Just to hear this.
You know, so far throughout the conversation, I think you're providing great current understanding and perspective surrounding food allergy diagnosis, management, risk, and things like that. It's all been very reassuring. Of course, as you mentioned, we still want to make sure we clarify the diagnosis and help people know how to avoid their allergen and prepare for reactions. So let's move on to, you know, something you really specialize in. What can you tell us about current treatment approaches for food allergy?
How much time do we have left? This is most likely a podcast of its own or multiple podcasts. But yes, we live in a fantastic time, I think, as a very interesting time for food allergists. And there have been a lot of changes in how we approach management. So now, of course, in addition to the standard and traditional avoidance that we've had for many, many years, we have a lot of active approaches. So oral immunotherapy is, of course, one of them. And the FDA approved the first drug for oral immunotherapy for peanut allergy back in 2020 now. And very recently, biologic omalizumab was also approved for food allergy therapy, both single and multiple food allergies. And there are lots and lots of others in the pipeline. There's epicutaneous immunotherapy, where you administer the food through a patch that is applied on the back. There's sublingual immunotherapy, where you use drops under the tongue to administer the immunotherapy. There are multiple other biologics. I could talk for days about therapies. But I think the important thing to note here is that all of these therapies and treatment approaches, and actually all the management approaches, come with their own risks and benefits. And it is becoming more challenging to choose for patients, especially if they are not aware of all the information for each therapy. And this is where we come in nowadays. Our role, I think, has changed over time. So we need to be able to give them all the information they require to make the right decision. So shared decision making, I think, is here to stay for all of our consults and all of our conversations with patients. And it's actually them that will be making these decisions in the future. We provide them with all the evidence-based information. We give them the options. And then we listen to them and we hear what they're wanting out of the therapy, what their goals are, what they value most, what preferences they have, what trade-offs they're willing to make. And all of these factors need to be considered before making a decision about therapy.
You're right. We could have three separate podcasts on all of these different options, but unfortunately, we'll have to have you back to discuss it at some point. So if I may ask, like you said, there's a lot to go through. This is evolving, even just in the last few months. Now we have another treatment option with omalizumab being approved for the treatment of food allergies. How do you handle this in the midst of a very busy clinic setting? Are you, is your staff participating in this? Do you have handouts? Do you have kind of a spiel and allow time for questions? Or, you know, what have you done to sort of incorporate this very important conversation into your visits?
So I probably do a combination of everything that you mentioned. I obviously talk to them myself. We have handouts that we provide. Most of our staff have been trained to also answer questions. The important thing is to give them time and actually hear what they have to say. It can be quite overwhelming receiving a huge volume of information about various therapies in one visit. So I generally make sure that they have the opportunity to come back for a second visit, sometimes even for a third visit, if they have a lot of questions. I generally encourage them to read the information and then write down the questions that they have for the next visit. And a lot of them actually contact me with questions through my chart. So that's another way that I handle this. I also point them to reliable resources online. I give them information, obviously, about the Code AI and the college and all these reputable websites where they can actually get correct information, evidence-based information, if they want to learn more about the therapies on their own.
Yeah, it's it takes a lot of planning, right? You have to be purposeful in how you integrate this into the midst of a busy clinic setting.
That's true. That's true.
Okay. I suppose we have to just touch upon the dark side of food allergy, which unfortunately exists, and we're aware of it. And one of those areas is really, you know, there's multiple websites. I mean, there's not just one, there's multiple websites and companies and individuals that are claiming that they have a cure for food allergies. And all of them tend to offer some variation of these non-validated tests. And then they have their own unique sort of quote unquote treatment method. Well, one, is there a cure for food allergy? And two, how should we counsel patients when they ask us about these websites?
Yeah, so I find that it helps a lot to, first of all, listen to them. So if they mention something like this to me, and it's kind of interesting, it usually comes in a very sort of sneaky way. So I will be having like a consultation and then somebody's going to say, I have to ask a really stupid question. And I can almost tell what's coming. Mm-hmm. And I always say to them, there are no stupid questions here. So this is also really important. We can't expect them to know these things. We can't expect them to be able to recognize these websites, you know, these forms of unvalidated testing. They're not physicians, they're not necessarily medical, and they're not allergists. So I think it's really important to make them feel comfortable to ask all of these uncomfortable questions that they may think are stupid, but they're not stupid, actually. They are true mm-hmm. questions that somebody who doesn't have the background of medicine would actually ask, and why would they, right? So I start by listening and I say, just tell me, you know, your questions, tell me what you looked at. They show me on their phones often which website they're looking at. And again, I don't dismiss them because, I mean, they're human, right? Hope makes us human. So everybody hopes for a magical cure for their problem, whatever that is, and for their disease. What I do is I try to teach them how to recognize these websites, how to actually see what information is correct and what isn't, and little tips on which resources they should be seeking out, like reputable websites, like I mentioned before, from the Code AI and the college, et cetera. I teach them how to evaluate news items and sound bites, how to navigate social media, especially my teenage patients. And I generally say to them at the end, you know what, if it sounds too good to be true, then it probably isn't, right? And this is something that is applicable, I think, to multiple areas, not just food allergies, right? How many messages do we get about getting a new job that's going to pay us $1,000 an hour by sitting at home? Now, who believes that? So if it sounds too good to be true, it probably isn't. That's usually my final phrase. But you may want to weigh in on this, Dave, because I know you do, as I said before, a lot of work in this space.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. These families are victims, right? I mean, these tactics aren't just for food allergy. You see this across the internet. It's snake oil, and it just takes on exactly. new forms throughout time. So I love what you said about listening to their concerns, validating them, taking sides with them, walking them through it. And, you know, I often, you know, just like you, I'll say, look, I wish there was, believe me, I don't want to have a job, at least this job. I would love if there was a cure. But unfortunately there's no evidence that demonstrates that at this time. So yeah. All right. Well, thank you for addressing that. I think that's something that we had to talk about here. I could keep you for hours and days. You're amazing and you've given us fantastic information. I do like to ask our guests to make predictions from time to time. We won't hold you to it unless you get it right, of course, and then we'll give you all the credit in the world. But if I put you on the spot, if you had to predict the next major breakthrough in food allergy diagnosis or treatment in the next 10 years, so by 2034, what do you think that's going to be and why?
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. Let's see, I'll try to get it right so that you can give me a shout out 10 years from now. I think that one of the challenges we're facing is something that we actually mentioned earlier on in the podcast about the wide variation and wide diversity that we see in how our patients present. No one food allergic patient is exactly the same as the next one. There are so many variations in the clinical presentation, the biomarker expression, natural history, disease severity, response to therapy. I could go on and on and on. So my prediction is that 10 years from now, thanks to all the great work that so many smart people are doing in our field, we're going to have a better understanding of food allergy phenotypes and endotypes, and we'll be able to hopefully risk stratify our patients better, have a better characterization of their food allergy severity, and also be able to individualize therapy options and choices based on each patient. Maybe it is too optimistic, but that's what I am predicting and hoping for.
Does this involve artificial intelligence in your prediction?
It might. It might. I think there's untapped potential there. Of course, some challenges and potential dangers, but also some untapped potential, yes.
Yeah, I think that's great. And we'll see. I mean, if you're right, we'll have you back and then you can gloat. How about that?
Excellent. Love it.
Dr. Anagnostou, this is amazing. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us today, especially in time for Food Allergy Awareness Week. I think this is going to be a very useful conversation for a lot of our listeners. Before we depart, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think it's kind of fair enough to end with something personal, since you asked me something personal to start with. So before doing this podcast, Dave, I connected with a good friend who's a very engaging speaker, or at least I consider him to be a very engaging speaker. And he recently also did a podcast that I absolutely loved, to ask him how he does it, right? And he said to me, just go and share your stories, Catherine. So I hope I did this. I hope I shared some nice stories for all our listeners today, and I hope that they found them informative and interesting. And what I'm doing for Food Allergy Awareness Week is I'm actually dedicating some extra time in my clinics to listen more to my patients' stories. And I'm hoping that some will surprise me, and I'm also hoping that I will get a better insight into their daily lives. So thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you again. We hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode. Please visit www.aaai.org for show notes and any pertinent links from today's conversation. If you like the show, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, Amazon, iHeartRadio, or Spotify, so you can receive new episodes in the future. Thank you again for listening.